Morning, everybody, or good afternoon.
Good morning.
Hello.
So I thought while we wait for other people to join us, in reading this week, there was a poem that I wrote. I'm not a very good poet, but I was responding to a poem.
Yeah, she just cut out, actually.
okay, I'm back.
Hi.
Hi. So I thought I'd just share the actual poem that was written by John Dotson that I was responding to. He's a much better poet than I am. It's in his book, Rivulets of Light. And it's poems about Point Lobos and Carmel Bay. So just while people are getting on, I'll read John's poem. It's called A Thousand Gulls, and it has this picture of the gulls there at Carmel. I think this is Point Lobos, actually. A thousand gulls. Well, maybe not quite so many. Or maybe it was more. At the mouth of the Rio today. As I watched the fresh water, deep river brown of valley drowned beneath the saltwater waves, beaks aligned upstream, untoward estuary, a gaggle of gulls were swept swiftly backward by the current unto the breakers, where just before dawn they lifted off one by one, and then all together, swerving up and over the waves in a great arc. Then to return and land on fine-grained sand, cycle after cycle. Then one bird, daring after another, ventured back into the river, beaks aligned upstream, untoward estuary, flapping, ducking, floating, unresisting, backward drawn. Down to the very brink of oceanic catastrophe. Almost then, all disrupted and patterned out over the waves to return again and again and again, land on hot, dry sand, cycle after cycle. So it was that I was convinced of their joy, sure as anything. It was completely clear to me. They were just having fun. So that's John's poem. All right, so how are you all today?
Good, thanks. It was a very cool poem, too. Thank you for reading it.
You're welcome.
And I see the similarity of your poem to it as well. And she's gone.
Her again.
Okay. Sorry about this bizarre internet connection thing. I don't know why it keeps dropping me.
Marco, do you have some advice here? Could she turn off the video? Would that assist maybe?
That could assist if it's a bandwidth issue.
Yeah. If you turn off your video, Lisa, we'll hear your voice, but we won't see your face, but it won't break up as much as it was. Would that be useful?
I just moved my Wi-Fi a little closer to the computer, so let me see if that works a little better. Okay. Let's just kind of review our circumambulation here. It might seem like we're kind of going in circles. Hopefully they're useful circles that are getting bigger and interconnected. We started with boundaries and then went to ego boundaries and the experience of losing ego boundaries. And then talked, but this isn't exact, you know, linear thing, but we also talked about standing outside of something and describing it from the outside versus like standing within and coming from that different perspective, and looked at a few basic assumptions that language makes about separateness and structure, subject, verb, object. That's related to the standing outside of one another, as Steve Rosen talks about in the reading for today, describing the points that make up space as being outside of one another. We talked a little bit about function words and how they orient us in Cartesian space, you know, above, below, to the left, to the right, through, under, within. I'll just interject here. What if we lose our orientability? Or what if we purposefully climb out of that perspective? And the Klein bottle helps as a mental model for doing that, and for containing the interpenetrating opposites. It embodies a paradox wherein boundaries are dissolved such that the discontinuities like inside and outside become continuous. So that points out to a kind of internal mediation or mutual permeation of opposites. And then we related that to discoveries in biology, such as our profound symbiosis. So it's not just physics that's requiring us to rethink these kind of different approaches to what boundaries are and what containing means and what inside and outside are. You know, both physics and biology are requiring us to rethink these things, to find new ways to speak about it, to, Barbara Marx Hubbard says, tell a new story. And she influenced me in that, got me thinking about transforming our relation to evolution from being something that it happens to, like we're just sort of pawns in an evolutionary game, which to some extent we might be, but also as something that we can actively participate or co-create within. and say, well, okay, if we're going to evolve, let's push it this way, or let's push it that way. Let's be co-creators in an evolution. And Gebser's notion of mutations of consciousness is one way to look at that type of evolution and how we can be involved with it. So that's a real quick recap. Let's talk today about what kind of news story might we want to tell? Are the readers that we're reading, showing us ways to tell a news story that's useful? And if not, how would you do it? What would you do? What kind of news story would you tell? And then in the telling of the news story, how does the language we have limit us? And how might we want to come up with something to break through those limits? That's kind of what we're about here in terms of consciously evolving language. So it's been a rough week. You guys look like you've all had a rough week.
I've had a couple of rough weeks. I have an excuse for why I look the way I do.
True, you do. You do.
So, but that's just me, all right? Everybody else is responsible for themselves.
So do you want to start someplace different? Do you want to start by talking about, did you have any questions with the reading? Did you have any arguments with the reading? How did it go?
I'll just say I thank you for the recap. Thank you for kind of walking us, retracing our steps. I did have a rough week, not in a bad way, just in a kind of destabilizing, but on the way to restabilizing transitional kind of way. And so I'm still like in the midst of personal transitions and I'm fine and I'm glad to be here. But I would like to ask about the question of agency, because it seems to come up in various threads. When we talk about conscious evolution or consciously evolving language, we're talking about some kind of agency, some kind of self that, or who is making decisions, directing things, conceiving and executing conceptions of things. That's at least just a really quick way of what I would understand by agency. Sometimes we talk about language, or some thinkers, such as Heidegger, have talked about language having agency, have said, like, language is speaking, language is doing something despite us, or outside of our cognizance, outside of our conscious awareness or control. And then there are other, thinkers and approaches that look at other factors, other kind of, sources of determining like what the outcome is through us and through language. So I would ask to the group, like, how do we understand the role of agency in relation to language and our consciousness and where we're identifying as conscious selves who could be evolving language?
So can we start by looking at what's your agency hierarchy? So where, if you start with, there's something and there's nothing, okay, like in creation, and the something gets divided into light and dark, is there agency yet? You can just nod your head or shake your head. When something gets formed out of the void, is there agency yet? When the something gets formed into, you know, planets, is there agency yet? When planets get populated by, well, let's just, you know, start out with the single-celled critters in the soup, is there agency yet? When the single-celled critters come together to form multi-celled critters, is there agency? You know, and we can keep going on and on and on, you know, when the multi-celled critters, you know, become cold-blooded, is there agency? When they become warm-blooded and live on the, you know, the surface of the earth, is there agency? When they become ape-like, is there agency? When the apes become humans, is there agency? So is there agency, you know, in the mountains, in the rocks? Is there agency in the birds? Is there agency in said an emergent phenomenon, something like a tornado or a hurricane? You know, let's question where are boundaries for what has agency and what doesn't have agency, just where they are personally. Different cultures have different boundaries for where agency resides. So let's just identify our own.
I apologize for being late. I was struggling, I hate to admit, finding the link, but hello everybody, and forgive me for being late. I assume you were speaking of like the life of the cell thing put forth by biologists who talk about a cell having agency and then building on that. Is that right?
It could be. I haven't read that book. I'm coming more from like a linguistics perspective of, you know, category divisions, and agency hierarchies are one of the category divisions that linguists and anthropologists look at in a language and in a culture, more so in a culture, because the culture is what defines, you know, the linguistic categories. You know, like in Eastern Canada, the Mi'kmaq talk about, so one of their main staples, food staples, are beavers. And they talk about beavers as persons. So beavers have personhood. They don't mistake beavers for people. But because beavers have personhood, they treat them differently when they go out to kill them. they understand that beavers' social organization is very much like human social organization. There's, you know, a family unit that lives in a particular, you know, beavers build those. They don't just build dams. They build their little beaver houses. I forget what they're called. But they give the beavers like more agency than I hate to say we, because I don't really know who the we is, but let's just say non-Mi'kmaq people. We wouldn't think of beavers as persons. They have stories. They have teaching stories about, you know, the woman who married a beaver, things like that. So that's just an example of a different culture that has a slightly different agency category than we have.
Buffalo would be the same. So, indigenous people gave agency to animals more than beavers, but buffalo, for instance, was treated similarly.
Yeah. So I'm trying, Marco, to get us to step back just a little bit, you know, before we dive into your question, which is a really great question, to just, you know, look at where do we draw the boundaries about agency, and knowing that, then how do we answer your question about how we talk about agency.
I'll jump in, Lisa. Thank you for that.
Great.
That hierarchical arrangement. I found myself, as you were describing that hierarchy of agency, and where is the agent? I felt there was a split between movement and stillness. Should be in everyone's list. Does it move? but that's working with the human scale. And I'm very aware that as you went up that hierarchy, you went from into something that I can only visualize and that is inferential, like a cell or an atom. I have never seen a cell. I've never heard, tasted, touched a cell. I have seen images and books, and I've seen exogenous, what I would call exogenous, externally generated images. And I think there's something to be said for that. That's a certain kind of knowledge and a very important kind of knowledge. But it isn't a knowledge that I would make a claim. It comes from my personal sense of agency. It has much more to do with the knowledge claims of the culture which I am a member of, and that I use and exchange symbols with. We're swimming in a sea of semiotica. And I think it's a slippery slope we're on, because I think there's a very big difference between an image that's endogenously generated, a created image from my own sensorium, and what I think you said, what Barbara Hubbard calls the exogenetically, the language as a design innovation, a way to pass on information exogenetically. So I think we're in this kind of a dilemma, impasse, conflict, paradox. And I don't think we can solve it. I really don't, at the human scale. I mean, we may participate and operate with different kinds of scales. I'm perfectly sure we are. I mean, when we go to sleep at night, our cranium encloses our brain in total darkness. And yet, many of us report that we can see a light. We could see a scene occur. We can participate with others who are moving around or standing still or flying, or we can see pools of water. We can climb trees. We can journey in underworlds and journey in overworlds. I mean, well, where's that light coming from? I think it's a really important question to ask. And the nature of image and the status of image, which has an image has a very low status in our exogenetically oriented culture, which doesn't even recognize any other rhythms except for the waking state rhythm, which is extremely fragile. There, we know, once again, scientifically, this has been verified, their brain waves, and they would go in and out of many different kinds of phases. So anyway, I'm just putting that out there because I have no clarity on this. I do have a lot of experience with endogenous imagery, and I've worked with a lot of other people and using language in a very restricted way in order to develop endogenous imagery in a relational field. This, I think, has much more in common with the shamanic traditions. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm sharing that with you guys because I think it's a very, I think that personal pronoun I think I'm quoting here. I don't know who I'm quoting exactly, but I think it was Stephen Rosen. How can the subject influence an object from which it is split? And my question is, can we be subjects and objects? Can subjects and objects be different without being split? And how does language... that's your question. But anyway, I'm just throwing that out there because I don't have any answers. I don't think anyone does. But I think the personal pronoun I value enormously. I'm not for dissolving into the void. I think we can't have a relationship to the void or anything else without a personal pronoun I. And I think I think we share that with all kinds of beings, human and other than human. And I think it's something that we should really give a lot of our meta attention to. So anyway, that's my two cents. Hope that's useful to somebody. Thank you so much for this opportunity once again.
So just is the I atomic? Can it be broken up into constituent pieces, or is it a primitive that can't be broken up? Is there such a thing as sub-agency or sub-I or sub-subjective? Subjective, anyway, something like that. Because I tend to be interested in, you know, I think in our modern environment, we've moved from thinking of ourselves as singly identified into multiply identified. But I don't necessarily, that doesn't necessarily mean that we have several eyes, but it does say something about the I that's different from what was said in the past, I think. And also when we, as a writer, when we write, you know, our characters have a kind of an I that's different from our I as a person. And so there's another kind of subjective form going on there. So anyway, I'm raising a question. I'm not really answering it.
I suppose you could say that the I is broken up with complexes, but the way that we transcend the I is compassion, love, isn't it? I mean, if we're identifying with another entity and feeling what they're feeling in a sense, we've overcome the I and included something else. Are we discussing the the essay, that very dense essay on that philosophic idea about subject-object?
Well, I have to say I haven't done the reading this week because I've had also a very difficult week. So I'm sorry. And I wonder whether I should even show up. But I thought, well, what the heck? So I'm
speaking in
general terms. So, but that's a kind of super I, right? So a sub I and a super I don't know. So, you know, does Gaia have an I? Is there a Gaia? Does Gaia have an I? A subject sense?
That's a very good question.
I had some observations to make on the essay. Is anybody into that? The reading was difficult, Lisa. That was dense. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I just excerpted a little piece for you.
It occurred to me in reading it that that people get to the same conclusion different ways. I mean, he was breaking down the subject-object and the nature of time and space in the way that we in the West do. And it was really exhausting to follow it. And it occurred to me, and I don't mean to discount the intellectual work that it took to do that, but I'm wondering, isn't that other people do it differently? For instance, he mentions Anaximander talking about the cosmic ocean of chaos, out of which an object arises, or subject-object arises. And, you know, the Indians have an image of that, Vishnu sleeping on the same, in the snake Ananka, which means unending, unformed. And it's a mythological image that's absolutely universal. Otherwise, people have been presenting this idea of being a dream and being in a dream where there really isn't a subject-object. I mean, if you're part of a dream, then you're part of a singularity that isn't broken into what the classic West, the view of the West. And so in mythology, they have sort of jumped that paradox with this image of being in a dream. And everything in the dream is, of course, connected. And I also thought of chaos theory when it starts talking about predicting weather systems and predicting anything. The system is too large that you wouldn't ever have enough computers to talk about every particular event in the universe simultaneously in order to predict a cause-effect kind of action, that we never know in this system, this huge dream, where we are. And so we cannot predict things because we're completely interconnected into a singularity. We're all within a singularity that we cannot comprehend. And we only can see patterns within, which is what they do in chaos theory. They look for the patterns. So in metaphor, I can get where this essay was going, pretty much, but it was really painful to get there intellectually. I don't know how others felt about the essay.
So is there, go ahead.
I just want to say, surprisingly, it made perfect sense to me, although I usually struggle. But I read very well the subject-object. I understood it clearer what he wanted to say in the like classical point, and how the dividing object we want to make ourselves whole. But then there is so I mean, at my level, everything made sense. But I wanted to say about I, I started to make conscious effort to say I versus we, and whatever. I think it's important for us to, like, even if it's from multiple personalities, our split, but from whatever I we speak, it's important to express that from my point of view, express my experience, there is the problem with the influence of, so we are bombarded with so much information that we can lose our personal, like tuning into our personal I, our personal experience. But through that, we will come to this, I already expressed this thought that it will unite us, but we all have to speak from our personal experiences, from our I, but we need to find it deep within what it is, what is our truth, even if it will be evolving and influencing.
So I'd like to bring a couple of these points back to Marco's question. So Kate, you mentioned causality. Is causality related to agency? Are agents those who go out and cause things? Also to what Misha was saying, can a bigger system than the I be an agent? These are all questions. I don't have answers to them. Go ahead, Kate.
I think it's a matter of scale. We seem to have cause and effect very immediately where we stand, but if you move out, I mean, doesn't every mystic talk about the transcendence that happens when suddenly they merge with everything and they're no longer an I? I mean, we're told, we're given reports of this. We don't necessarily operate on that level of consciousness, but can we take it as a given that the I is an illusion to some extent because people transcend it? And they speak about merging with everything else. I'm going to assume that that's a dimension that you can be in. I'm not in it. I mean, where I am, cause and effect are very real. And my ego is real. And all of the things, the subject object is very real. What we're talking about is a perceptual level. We are on a perceptual level where these rules hold. We're talking about perceptual levels where they don't.
Yeah, like I was thinking about the new story. Maybe the new story should be the remembering, coming back to the old story when we had, you know, the people experienced magical and, you know, mythical, the Gebses, the division of consciousness, his ideas. Like like example, I can give my recent example with my grandson. He had a very rough time and was like very like acting up, and I always take him to the nature, and we went to the little pond actually where the beavers live, and my dog was chasing them all around, so we were sitting there, and he remembered that we went to that place, and I'm like, this is a special place, you could just like, let's sit and listen to the wind, watch the pond, the ripples in the wind. And then I remembered the story about the oracles in Greece, ancient Greece, that they could tell that because there was rustling of the leaves, that they could read predict the future by listening to the rustling of the leaves. And I was telling it to Felix, and all of a sudden, like the leaves started rustling, like the wind started blowing even harder, and the rustling became like very, very distinct. And I looked up and it was an oak tree, and they used oak trees. And it was right. I never noticed that it was an oak tree right under this, like above us. But this was the moment of like, this is the story, like that we have to experience this. And then, so Felix started to do his, like all of a sudden, the kind of like the rituals, like he started doing like energy very spontaneously, and the wind started to blow, and I'm like that, and I really felt like the wind is us, like wind going through us, and we are the wind, and it's like, it's just like this moment, which we, that's the story that we have to come back to it, and it's the through experiencing it, experiencing this unity, and that we are really like, it felt like we are wind. It's just like magical, really magical, something like that.
Yeah. So, you know, imagine not just in nature, but things like that happening, you know, say on the bus, like Kate had a story about that being on a bus a while back, or, you know, while at work. I wish I had magical experiences like that while at work.
Can I respond to something I think Kate said about our personal agency and a larger system that might have a sense of agency? And is there a relationship between that larger system and our personal pronoun I, however we can configure that? And I've been aware, I'm thinking about, maybe it's because it's a political season, but the power of the egregore. The egregore is emerges out of multiple agencies. So a group of people get together and they use symbols which represent real forces to them, and share those symbols and rituals. Then something emerges out of that collective recognition. And that can have immense power and can even develop an autonomy from the group. This is a very old magical notion, but it's also the foundation for all of our religions, and I would claim most of our science as well. We create through the language games, symbolisms that we share, narratives, ritual, I did something intentionally this week. I had a Buddha on a little pedestal. I have a kind of altar. And it was a head of a Buddha. And I took the Buddha away. And I hid it somewhere. I know where it is, but I wanted it not to be in a central place on a pedestal. So in a sense, I killed the Buddha. It's an egregore. It's an agent that has been produced and has emerged out of a field that many, many, many millions of people have put their energies into. So we have a personal sense of I, we have a field of all possibility. We enter into that field, hopefully with an agency that we then can bring forth from the field certain benefits to ourselves and to our collective. But there's no guarantee that that is so. And I think we're living in a world where that's so fragmented, and that we've unleashed all kinds of egregoric autonomous intelligences that we can't deconstruct and put away safely, as I did Buddha's head. You know, I can do that because I'm creating conditions for a kind of experiment of my own. How can I disentangle from the frozen mythologies that previous eras have laid down? And this is where I think Kate and I have had some issues around what the hell an archetype is all about. And I read your description, and it's very similar to my own. But as Kate said, you know, these are hardwired in our psyches. And my question is, how hardwired are these archetypes in our psyches? And can we change that wiring? Can we rewire our psychic systems? Or are we doomed to be pawns in a archetypal or egregoric battlefield? I that's an open question for me. I experiment quite a bit. I consider my own sensorium a laboratory, and that's my metaphor. And I'm intent upon rewiring. And I believe there are other agencies besides my own who are interested in the human getting rewired. And I believe that could be part of our potential in narrative and story, new symbols emerging, rather than relying on this path dependency, where we're just producing bigger and bigger and bigger weapons to destroy our civilization. And, you know, saying, well, gee whiz, that's what we do. There's nothing we can do about it. That's human nature. I'm open to believe something different. And I'm not saying all the religions and all these egregore forces are bad. Some egregores, I think, are quite friendly and benevolent. But I think it's really important that we honor and respect that we have this powerful, our imaginations. And I would say the imaginal, not just the imagination. It's not just visualizing in a creative way, which is great. It's actually, there's an objective status to the imaginal realms. There are thought forms that you can visualize and you can create thought forms. And there are some entities, there are some intelligences. You cannot dismiss them. You cannot dissolve them. You cannot say, get thee gone. they are more powerful than you are. So that's my challenge, is knowing the difference between an egregore, a thought form that I have created, and therefore I don't have to obey, I can dissolve it. Or it's this, if I say all thought forms dissolve, and there's one figure there that doesn't dissolve and all the others do, I have to sort of make a determination. It's a very indeterminate determination about what is my relationship to this entity that I cannot dissolve. So I'm just sharing that with you guys, my own quandary here.
John, I think that our misunderstanding about archetypes is doomed to continue. I don't think of archetypes as our constructions. I think you say, can't we change? Well, can you change the moon and the stars? Can you change? Yeah. Archetypes are a word we give to something that is behind the way that we are. It isn't that we are prisoners of these archetypes. We're prisoners of our interpretation of the archetypes. When we don't evolve them, when we don't work with them, then we get into a fix like we are now, with everything melting. You know, you have to work with the forces of human nature, because that's what you are. And imagination is how you transform them and change them into other things. So archetypes are not man-made artifacts of our history. They are echoes that are bouncing off something we don't understand. And we keep creating metaphorical forms for them. And when the metaphors wear out, we do have to remove them, and we have to imaginatively come up with another version that serves us. I mean, we're in a classic, as I keep repeating, deluge mythology, where our definitions have all dissolved. They don't work. Our belief systems are outworn. We have to come to a new agreement about what is real. And that is a work of imagination, but it doesn't mean that we're dispensing with archetypes. It's because we're going back to them, to the deepest mythologies we have.
Can I ask you, is there a possibility that new archetypes can emerge? Since you've already said that they can change through our interpretation, I'm also suggesting they can change through our participation with them.
Well, that's the only way they
change. They have dark sides and they have a bright side as well. And we have to recognize and disentangle. And I think that's part of our agency, that we can recognize an archetype which isn't working for us, and we can disentangle from it.
I agree.
We can't kill the Buddha on the road if we need to kill that Buddha, if it's turned into an egregore.
I agree.
Yeah. Okay. So we're in. Oh, that's good. Okay. So we're in some agreement. Not that agreement is necessarily something that I'm requiring of anybody. I think there's differences, though, that don't need to divide us. That we can have differences in our relationship to the archetypal realm. And you say that we don't create them. But I say when we participate and interpret them in certain ways, and they change through that participation, then I think we're in a much more fluid zone of proximity where new narratives could start to emerge rather than just repeating the same old, same old, same old, same old.
Agreed.
Story we're all sick and tired of.
we create the metaphors. We don't create the archetype.
And so now this is a big topic, but I think there's the difference between the image, the endogenously created image of an archetype, which maybe have an exogenetic quality to it, since it's part of our culture and part of our social hierarchies. And that difference between that symbol and the image, and that's a very fuzzy area, I think. And that boundary between the inside and the outside that I don't want us to get rid of. I think it's a perfectly good boundary, but it's a permeable boundary, and it's a boundary that can change. It has a lot to do with our creativity and the context that we're in. So anyway, I'd love to hear other differences people have. Thank you.
Like in Lisa's the reading for today, that we are co-creators and we create the future. It's interesting that the future is, it's said that their visions of the future is self-fulfilled prophecies. And so there's a big danger in that we are stuck in this rational, like the our mode apparatus now, that we will, our prediction of the future will become self-fulfilled prophecy. Like speaking of the virus, for example, which is like I listened to, I took a course on this one of the schools of Buddhism, and they did there a lot about healing and imagining that we are Buddhas and we are healing the world. And this is like, the more people do that, the more there will be energy that will heal the world. But we don't have this vision. We were all like, everything's going to be bad. It's going to get worse. And which I don't know. But if we create new story, we can go beyond that this is doomed. That it's still not too late to change. Right?
Yeah, and throughout history, we have created new stories. In a different article, Steve goes through, you know, the physics stories that we've created over the years and how they've changed. But you could also look at, the U.S. as writing a new story. We don't like the story of having an authoritarian king, you know, whose whims we're subject to. We want some say in, you know, what happens within the polis. So we're going to create this thing, you know, called a democracy, and sort of wrote a new story for, you know, this country, with the help, of course, I have to say, of the people who already lived here, who were already living within a story of democracy.
I think my point would be that there's nothing new, you know, it's just a reworking of it, which is why I think people mistrust the past and the archetypes of the past as if that's going to hold us back. And my response is opposite. You know, I look back when I'm looking into this art collection that I'm working with, and it's all there. It's codified into patterns. And if you follow the way the correspondences work between meaning, it gives you the syntax that you need to look at the world and the new images coming at you so that you can organize them. It's like knowing the pattern helps you read the pattern that you're in. And we'd so dismiss mythology and mythological ways of looking at things as if it's going to stick us in the past. And I think of it oppositely. I think that by understanding the mythic and the magical, you understand the language, then you can deal with, because you know, we're not living as purely rational beings. You know, the French Revolution, they changed all the name of the churches to houses of reason. And we know how that worked out. We have to move with all of our intelligences. And all of our intelligences are mythic, magical, and intellectual, and an integration of those. So how are we going to integrate all of that if we refuse to treat it very seriously, or think that all of this mythological stuff is just the naive reactions of people who don't understand computers?
Or well, like in this article, the scientists who are just like all these speculations, it's all, you know, subjective and claim that they have objective truth. And it's also, yeah, that missing the so many, yeah, nuances and the whole realm, different realm of reality that they kind of deny.
So Kate, you're pointing to the news story that Gibbs or presented in EPO, which, you know, instead of thinking of our story as being, you know, completely linear, like we emerge from the, you know, pre-mythic and go through magic and mythic and, you know, mental and get somewhere, that it's all there all the time. It, you know, it's a story that hasn't quite made its way into the, you know, let's just say the popular consciousness, for lack of a better word.
You're mythical and magical, and I'm thinking in terms of Jung's definition for intelligences, which are intellectual, sensate, intuitive, and feeling. And, you know, in this group, I sort of mentally get people sort of, I understand that they're coming from, like, so much of John's intelligence is kinetic and in his body, and the way that he intuits things is so different from for instance mine to some extent. But I think that we have educated people to only one intelligence, and it smushes and mashes everybody else up. And that part of this integration isn't just the integration of the math, the mythical and magical. It's also the integrations of different ways of knowing, different ways that we're intelligent. And when I was living in Baku some 10 years ago, it's funny because the Czech Republic took down Russian monuments within about 10 minutes of the Velvet Revolution. And in places like Azerbaijan, they're still there because Russian culture was high culture to them. It wasn't, you know, the barbarians invading. So the statues were still there. And I remember looking up at this 30-foot statue of some patriarch with, you know, side whiskers and a frock coat, bronze or whatever. And he was 30 feet high and he had one arm raised, you know, blessing the people. And he looked absolutely ridiculous because, you know, it had been, what, almost 100 years since he was relevant. And this truly is the arrogance of our paradigm. We are at war with the giants, this sort of sense of certain knowledge that we know that we have reality under control and that we can dictate the terms of it. And it, the arrogance of it is so profound, and it's still what we're fighting. Is we're fighting in schools and everywhere that simply wants to delegate one form of intelligence as superior and delegate everybody else to anecdotal, to this major intelligence. And we don't integrate. We don't allow people to develop their own intelligences.
Oh, creativity, which is, yeah, that's all creativity springs, the, you know, imagination, that's the source of all creativity, of all creation. That's what being killed systematically.
I think there's something that's been mentioned about the stories. I think this was a question that Lisa asked at the beginning. And I think it's very important for us as storytellers, and we all are storytellers. We can't make much social sense at all unless we can tell a story to another person. And that other person won't listen to you very long unless you have a story to tell. They're going to ask you, what's the point? And I think that that's an attractor that we all have socially, to perform in a storytelling space with other storytellers. And can we be aware of what story we are using to tell our stories? I think this kind of a meta-awareness of the narrative is very different from the myth. The mythic, I believe, is frozen in ways that the narrative is not. I think there's a deep relationship between the mythic and the narrativizing that we do in our very, psychological society. So that's something that's useful. And I think all of our storytelling has some kind of logic operating that we're either conscious or unconscious of. And I think that's where, if we were aware of those logics that we use and that we're drawn to, and I think this is where the study of archetypes is extremely important and powerful. I think that we could be telling different kinds of stories with different kinds of attractors. And maybe, I'm sort of losing my train of thought here, but one exercise that I've given myself recently that is really challenging, because we talk about logic and cause and effect, and we all tend to think that we are living in a world of causes and effects. Bear with me here. We're used to if P, then Q. Remember that one in logic class? If this, then that. This follows from that. What if we dropped if P, then Q? What if we use the magic if to drop if P, then Q? Then what happens socially? What kind of imagination could function if we dropped if P, then Q? Are there other kinds of causalities that could emerge in the juxtapositions that could then happen, that could not happen if P, then Q? So I'm just opening that up as a possibility for how can we construct or reconstruct new kinds of narratives which are not hooked into the dark side, the egregore of an archetype that's been frozen. And also why I took the Buddha down was for a very practical reason. I'm looking for refuge. Where do I find my refuge? I found it previously in the Sangha. And I worked with a particular Sangha, with a particular teacher in a very hierarchically arranged social arrangement. And I had been initiated and there were rituals involved and practices. But that Sangha doesn't exist anymore. It was dissolved. And because the teacher was found by some of the students to be doing something unethical. So that Sangha having dissolved, and that Sangha was a member of a larger Sangha, the tradition has been some would say corrupted. So that's where I'm coming from, where I have to sort of recognize that I can no longer take refuge in that Sangha because that Sangha does no longer exists in the way that it did before. Maybe a new Sangha can emerge. But maybe that's not where I need to be placing my refuge, in another Sangha. I think we have to find refuge in our own consciousness ultimately. And I think this is actually sort of hardwired in some forms of Buddhism, where you do, you need to, if you meet the Buddha on the road, you should kill him because you don't want to. You need to find refuge in your own consciousness. Anyway, that's a challenge for us all, I suppose. Thanks.
So I'd like to come back, circle back to Marco, and you just took your, you just unmuted as if you knew I was. I just, yeah, let's check in with you, Marco, and your original question.
Oh, thank you for that. I'm not sure I have a point, though. That's why I'm kind of, you know, clicking on and off, and there's moments when I think, well, maybe we can go in this in a certain direction, and then I'm not so sure. But I do want to hold to this question of agency, because I mean, what occurred to me when you followed up and gave that hierarchy, which was more like a free, it wasn't so hierarchical. I mean, there was a kind of hierarchical, it was a zigzagging hierarchy. It had a lot of laterality to it as well, which I appreciated. But when I reflected on the question, I realized that part of what I think is a charge behind it is that agency for us in this realm, this human realm, is a struggle. It's not something that we can take for granted. And you talked about the American, you know, the American Revolution. You mentioned the French Revolution. The human story is one of various struggles for agency, I would say. A lot of that plays out amongst ourselves, between different groups, but it also plays out within ourselves, between different levels or aspects of our being, both what we would call lower in the sense of less conscious or darker, and higher in the sense of clearer, more lucid, more transcendent. These are just loose associations that are... but I wanted to come back to the essay too, which Kate, you read. I would started reading and I kind of I came up against some resistance in it, and I thought maybe that would be an interesting place to go, because I tend to like almost everything, almost all the conclusions that Rosen gets us to, but I almost never like the way we get there. I think it comes back to the kind of the core questions that we're working with in this essay, chapter one to this book, The Self-Evolving Cosmos. He starts the first sentence. He says, "The quest for unity in science may be traced to the oldest, most basic of human drives, that toward individuality." And he emphasizes individuality. And then he writes, goes on, "To be, quote, individual is to be undivided, to possess a unitary core, a coherent and stable center of identity. From its inception, human development is guided by the tendency toward individuation." And one, I think that individuality is not necessarily the same as individuation. So I think those two get conflated there. But two, and more fundamentally, I'm not sure that we can say or should say that the most basic of human drives is toward individuality. I think that that may already be kind of caught in the mental loop, like presupposing something that maybe is a lot more provincial, maybe is a lot more kind of bounded to a particular group of people or a population of people in a particular time. And that we could find a lot of other kinds of drives in conscious beings at different kind of evolutionary, you know, scales or levels of development that have nothing to do with, or not a lot to do with individuality, where maybe that's a part of it, but is part of a larger pattern or larger way of being. And that's what I hear Misha and John and Kate all speaking to, are these other logics that are not constrained to the subject-object space kind of static mental frame. And what I understand Rosen to be doing is sort of undoing that mental from within, like kind of exposing and disentangling the internal contradictions. But I think that there's a limitations to that approach, because if you start in the mental and you end in the mental, you, even if you point beyond the mental, you don't tend to leave it. And if the question is speaking from the integral, they're speaking from the sense of that new story, then I think we have to have a kind of a different presuppositions. And I think that that's part of what you're working with us, kind of leading us toward, like in the text, you give meditations, you give poetry. And so you draw awareness, you draw consciousness like out of that kind of atomizing, and framing tendency of the mental. But what we're struggling with too is that the mental is very powerful. The mental is its own force that if we can't integrate it with the mythical and the magic and the archaic and the perceptible chaotic sensorium, and our pattern, our general pattern recognizing capability, if we can't kind of wield the power of the mental, then we will, I think, be subject to it. And so I think this is where I was like losing my point, but what is powerful about the mental is its ability to connect dots and to see patterns and to establish causal chains, and then to use that understanding as kind of the basis for predicting what's going to happen. So if P then Q, the mental can establish very complex patterns of P's and Q's and different kinds of chains. That's what is part of what gives us agency. If we can understand what's going to happen, for example, with the climate or with the virus, I mean, to the extent that collectively as a human species, we've developed mentally, coordinated technologies to track the rate of infection, where it's spreading, the lines of transmission, the different kinds of complex causal chains that cause, rapid acceleration in climate change. I mean, all of this is extremely mental, and it, we need supercomputers, and we need, networks of research institutions and sensors like strategically placed all over the globe, like to have a picture of what's going on the planet and amongst ourselves in this globalizing kind of moment we are, that we're just on the cusp of that. And that's that power to kind of conceive and predict things, even though it's limited, is only growing. And I guess part of like the edge of what where I'll leave this off and see what happens next is that I think we have to go back to the magic and the mythic, but I'm not sure that we've fully reckoned even with the mental, and that part of what is happening here is that the mental is like exponentially accelerating, and it's in a sort of uraboric self-feedback, like consuming loop, where it's a kind of agency unto itself that's like picking up a lot of power. I mean, this is the idea of the singularity, is that you know, all of these forces converge into very totalizing systems. And so I think that that kind of, maybe to bring it back and transition off and hand it off, like that's where the struggle for agency, I think, really comes in, is that sense of I that we have, that we can disidentify from the mental and the archetype and, you know, what is arising in the moment. And become aware of larger patterns or larger movements, and coordinate on the basis of that higher awareness. I mean, I think that that's part of the direction that we have to go. And I don't know if I'm making sense anymore, but hopefully that is stimulating to the group.
Yeah, I was like in his Rosen's, this when he writes about drive to coherence, table center of identity or individuality, I interpreted for myself as drive to wholeness. And then when he goes through the, so it's a kind of how I understood that it's like inevitable, the division, subject object division. But one, so like what scientists do, they finally they come to the point that there is no they are stuck. If there's if they don't go beyond that, they will be stuck and dogmatic. And so that's what he leads to. And then he
So that was the point about the line, that the infinite divisibility. I mean, that in itself tells you that that the mental doesn't work past that point, like that you run into the paradoxes at the edge of the frame. So yeah, you have to flip into something, another awareness there.
It's almost like, to me, it's like inevitable that you have to go through that to, yeah, like you said, that we have to really, like, what does mental do? What's this rational mode that we operate? What, like, we have to understand the nature of that and what it leads to and where we get stuck and become.
Yeah, we're not recovered yet from the mental. And I think that Lisa's point about Gebzer is that we're going to be able to evolve the mental by being able to integrate the others. And you mentioned something about the way the modern mental can predict and control. And the shadow of that is, I think, has to do with COVID-19, the pandemic, and the way completely, because we are at a point where science is sort of codified into a single narrative driven by special interests. It isn't really science. All discussions about the virus and what it is and how it works are fed through a single interpretation. I mean, the research, the way pharmaceutical companies work, who's funding research, who's developing vaccines, the whole conversation is contaminated. I mean, it's not science. It's
nobody's else. Talking about the virus as an agent.
Yes. And no one is talking about how this research in virology is looking at infection completely differently. I mean, never mind, we suppress all narratives about how these vaccinations can be contaminated with very unhealthy things. We won't talk about that either, but we won't talk about the way they're using statistics and the death rates. And we're not really able to have a discussion about it because the conversation is being controlled. So you think of science as being this sort of unbiased, truth-seeking enterprise, but it's not.
I'd like to be.
I think. Go ahead, John.
Briefly, I'll try to summarize this, because I agree with what Kate said. I agree with what Marco said. I believe that the mental, the deficient forms of the mental that we Gebzerians refer to, I think that's egregoric. I think the mental becomes an idol that we worship. And I think the healthy forms of the mental, efficient forms of the mental, could investigate with the mental, the magical and the mythical and the archaic. And I think that would evolve to something that we could then, create communities around called the integral. I don't think we're there yet, but I think we could imagine such a possibility. We could create a different kind of as if. I also had a direct experience. I went to the Museum of Modern Art with a friend of mine, and for the first time in my life, they measured my temperature before I could get in. And they didn't, there was no thermometer. I had a mask on. They told me to look into a machine. The machine just had a black hole in it. And it looked like some sort of video camera. And then they said, okay, you can go in. And so I guess they registered 98.98. What is a healthy human temperature? Whatever that is, they were able to record it without touching me, without using a thermometer. And I thought, oh, this is very interesting. And I commented to my friend that I felt like we were going into a prison or a hospital rather than a museum. And we were all social distancing. We all had our masks on. It was really kind of weird. But I'm just saying that what happens, though, and this is already happening, I understand. I read about this. I don't know if it's good science or not. But there are some children whose baseline temperature is changing. So it may be that there may be a future species that was related to ours, which will no longer be like us at all. And they may have a different normal temperature than we do. And that may be happening very rapidly. This may not be generations away from us. So I'm just bringing that up as another cause of worry, that the science that we practice now and that we worship in our universities and schools, and there are certainly innovators within them in those places, but they're often very much persecuted. We may be, what is a fact? What is fiction? How can we separate facts from values? I mean, these are very, very big philosophical questions, but I think that we need to use not just our imaginations. We need to get much more comfortable with the imaginal. And I believe at the integral, we would recognize that good science, good myths, the good magic, healthy, efficient forms of all of those can be negotiated when we can use the different kinds of logics, paraconsistent logics, that the imaginal affords us, so that we don't have to have a nervous breakdown every time we have a without a vaccine or without a clearly defined theory for everything. So anyway, that's my spiel. I hope that's of use. Thank you very much for all of these great ideas.
I want to address what Marco said about the first, the motivation of the earliest people, to individuation or to be an individual. I agree with him. I think if the first questions were what's for lunch and do you want to get lucky, at least concordant with that was where am I? Where am I and what am I? And who made me or how did I get here? It wasn't about becoming an individual as much as wanting to know what we were in relationship to. And that's all early magic, all early ritual. It's about orientation to a center, to some kind of idea that who the imagined creator and the I were somehow connected in a dialogue. That's the whole nature of art, early art, ritual. So being an individual didn't even exist in those times so much as being a member of a tribe. It was a different way of being. But I think it was orientation to a center. You mentioned my essay, Marco. Did you happen to read it? Yeah. I missed the reference that you made to it. I didn't know if anybody would be interested in it.
You're muted, Marco.
What was the reference exactly that I made?
I think I made a reference to it. I don't know.
That to me was the first motivation.
What I responded to was the squaring the circle and the salt point.
Yeah.
And I don't understand that. I think I need to reflect on it more. Salt is a new element for me in you know, my understanding of the world. It was just a condiment up until you brought it up as being an alchemical feature. But what I wanted to say about individuality, I mean, to me, that's a particular kind of like modern, it's a modern mentality, you know, that one would want to be a separate self that is purely distinct. Descartes, like, you know, had this idea of clear and distinct ideas, and the idea that the I could be clear and distinct from everything else. That to me is a powerful egregore. And everybody wants to be a self, and everybody is the same as everybody else in wanting to be that. But that's not to say that we don't have individuality or that individual style isn't important. I think art is all about individual style, but it's about a play of style in a tradition, in a history, in a context where it's kind of understood that we can adopt, take on, play with, let go of styles, you know, as we move, you know, through our you know, our sensible space. When we talk about agency to this question, to me, there's a kind of fallacy in trying to locate that in the individual self, because it's the same thing with the line that you subdivide infinitely. You don't get to it. Like, you just keep on going into a kind of void that empties out into nothingness, past a point, because there's a lot of illusions along the way, and, you know, a lot of exogenous images that sustain, you know, different varieties of selfhood. But I think, I mean, what's really unique about language is that there's nothing exogenous about linguistic imagery. You have to generate it yourself, and what you interact with is the medium that is the, you know, the language and the words and the paralanguage that we participate in when we communicate. So if we could communicate, speak, write, interact, form culture in ways that don't presuppose that we all have to be hyper individuals, or that we have to have a perfect command and control of our environment through ever like increasing, you know, technologically kind of empowered rational means. But we could do that because it's part of our power to do so, like that we are developing as a human civilization. To me, that's like the attractor, is to essentially live in a sort of artistic civilization that is has gained the powers of magic, mythic, mental, and has integrated them, and now can do something with them. Because right now they're doing things with us. The archetypes are playing us rather than us playing with them. I feel like that's the potential of this inquiry. And, you know, I think that conscious evolution is a kind of under-researched, like kind of an under-reflected area. I think we've had like initial visionary, communiques about what is possible through people like Barbara Marx Hubbard, who you honor in your piece, Lisa, and others. But I think we're still pretty naive about it too. And I certainly feel naive, like I feel like a child, you know, when it comes to the cosmic powers. And that's where I think we have to go. Like a cosmic civilization would have ways of working with its powers that are beneficial and are aesthetic, you know, rather than destructive and self-terminating. And I'll end there.
Bye, Lisa. You have to go, Lisa.
Yeah, I've got to jump on to a work Zoom session. But you guys can keep talking and I'll come back and listen to the recording. I think this has been a really, really great conversation. And the workshop is going to be next Tuesday at this same time. And we're going to get into Mobius strips and client bottles and a technique called polarity management, which is about integrating the opposites. So I'll see you there.
That sounds good. Thank you, Lisa.
Today.
Okay.
Thanks. Bye.
And if anyone wants to stay, I'm perfectly happy to join you in that. I know if other people have to go, that's cool. But I'd really love, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I don't know if you were finished, Marco, but I just wanted to
say, I hadn't seen Lisa's chat, so I didn't know that she had to leave, but I'm glad that
we can. But if anyone who hasn't had a chance to speak wants to speak, I would love to hear, you know, what you may have learned today, if anything.
To comment on Marco, if you want to understand salt, there are dozens of very obtuse biblical references to it. It's a symbol used a lot, but I don't think well understood. The point of that essay wasn't so much to bring truth and light, you know, in terms of what's real and what's not, as much as showing how mythological language works. That was the purpose. You know, that you end up with a salt point, which is a highly abstract construct, but it can move into all kinds of directions that aren't logical, you know, to a mountain and to NK sitting on the mountain, and it can be many other things. But we are used to thinking in rational categories, which prevents us from understanding myth, because we don't understand the lines of correspondence over which those symbols move. And so that was kind of my my expression of how it moves, you know, how these correspondences move.
When is our next meeting? Do you know?
So the workshop is next Tuesday. And then the Tuesday after that would be the next regular session like this. So Lisa was having trouble with the Tuesday, Thursday on the same week, just the way that it was spaced out. So I've hopefully consistently updated all the topics, and next Tuesday, same time, would be the next workshop, and then 2 weeks, then the week after that.
That's a lot easier for me, by the way, to make the workshop if it's in the same time as this slot, so because it's kind of booked anyway. So I still think that still interested in this sort of sub-identity thing, because I think it's not just about agency as independent from language, as a user of language, but I think language generates its own forms of agency. Mm-hmm. And the idea that characters or collections of words can form a sense of agency out of the collection, I think is an idea that is attractive to me, is something that I'm interested in exploring. So, you know, I'm not sure what else to say about it, but I do think it is a relevant issue to this context.
You know, William Burroughs said that language was a virus.
Yeah.
A language virus. It had an autonomy, and he thought it was lethal. Of course, he should talk. How many novels did William Burroughs write?
And of course, we talk about memes, which actually comes from partly, I think, Burroughs' work. But so memes are a kind of self-generating agency within language or in relation to language. So
right, I think it's that scale. We're all working with a different kind of scale, because I think there's a great deal that's under language that has to do with our nervous system. And the thresholds within our nervous systems, which can be tripped. You know, we can And I think language has can have a very soothing quality to our nervous system. Like when your mother is rocking you to sleep and singing a lullaby, you know, those are, that's, or when your boss tells you to get off your butt and do something. I mean, those are all obvious ways where our nervous systems are impacted. But I think that that aspect of language is very strange and weird. But I would grant you there may be a kind of agency that certain writers and poets and maybe actors perform that function in our society for tapping into the magical qualities of our language. So I just wanted to thank you for that. And the whole idea of agency, once again, Kate was talking about the mountain. And I think at a certain scale, yes, the mountain does have agency over many, many human lives, many, many generations. That mountain that has a peak high in the sky, maybe at the bottom of the ocean. And that's something that you could say of the virus, the COVID virus, has a powerful sense of agency. So I think that, yeah, I think we do need to sort of open up our non-human agency is extremely potent and powerful. And we need, I think, to start really paying exquisite attention to it. And I think we are, because the ice caps are melting, and that's going to have a lot to do with, you know, my commute, how I get around. You know, if Manhattan is underwater, it's going to be a very novel kind of situation for us. So anyway, thank you all for these insights. And anyone else has something to share before we all shut up and move on and do our own thing, I'd love to hear, you know. Thanks.
I was just thinking about how I have to change my language to connect, whether I use a foreign language or if I am, let's say, when I go back to Ukraine, to my village, to be like, people wouldn't accept me if I didn't adapt to and it plays a very important role, but it's almost like I become a different person. I'm totally different. Sometimes even I feel like that, like using different. And then I remembered one experience I had when I traveled in India, and you know, like the people always try, if they see you a foreigner, they will try to stop you nonstop. And it just became so difficult. And my Indian friend told me, like, pretend you're deaf and mute. And it worked like a charm. It's unbelievable. Like, I started just like I'm deaf and mute. So I may as well not be understand English, because English is not my first language. So I'll just, or I don't speak the language. So I will just be quiet, like silent, as if I... So, well, people would still, but they would, like, I would just walk as if, but I didn't have this attitude that I don't want to talk to you. I would just, like, walk and, like, I don't know what you want from me. And it everything became easier. And even, when I hire in a taxi, so I wouldn't talk. And he's like, where do you want to go? He's like, metro in New Delhi. And he's like, oh, I'll take you to, I said, this station, which was closer. And the person wanted to take me, the driver, the rickshaw driver, wanted to take me to the one where there's a shopping mall. He's explaining. I'm like, no. And I'm showing him what I wrote, that this train station. And he charged me like 10 times less for that. It was very short, like 5 rupees, like almost nothing. It changed like that. It's like, it was no language. And it's like, and I became much more open to the people, and I like more understanding, because I became very irritated, and I would react, and I would. So like there are people who are deaf and mute, like their vision of the world and their reality is also different, but there is something that unites us without language, spoken language.
Marco, can you give us a synopsis of, because it's sometimes I feel too scattered. We cover so much ground.
A synopsis of this conversation?
Yeah. What do you think the major points or the most points are? Where did we go? Anything accomplished?
You have to speak for yourself and us at the same time.
Oh, gosh. Lisa, to me, the primary theme, although we didn't explicitly address it, but from the writings, was this idea of conscious evolution. That's why I asked the question of agency after Lisa's opening remarks, because who or what aspect of us is the conscious part that is directing the evolution that is desired. And what I had in mind by that, and this is not by way of synopsis, but just is that, and it's interesting that Lisa went to the hierarchy of agency, but just that there is a complex agency, that agency is not simple. It's not reducible, you know, to a particular point of the individual, and that we have to take into account varying levels and dimensions where consciousness is active and where it has different levels of agency or different kinds of agency, different degrees even of agency. So it was interesting that Lisa then went to, she offered to, in response to my question, a kind of meditation, a kind of riff on where agency may arise, where it may cohere, and took us from the initial like sort of divisions of matter and light and dark to different kinds of organisms and, you know, potentially, you know, I think that where we might be verging to is different kinds of identity, different spiritual agencies. I think that that then brought in questions of the archetypes and of Jeffrey brought in sub agencies and super agencies. And John also talked about the I and the importance of having a stable center to orient amidst the whole, you know, the manifold of possibilities. Misha, I also offered a story that of taking his grandson to a natural area, a pond, and recollecting how the Greeks would divine, tell the future by the movement of the leaves, and how, as he was recalling that, he had a very similar experience with his grandson. And, you know, that opening up into maybe a different sense of what agency may be about, an agency not rooted in the human rational ego, but more diffuse, more mysterious, more magical. So I think that, I mean, we went on from that. That's hardly a synopsis, more of a recounting, but I think we explored different kinds of different modes, different, different types of agency. And we're, I think, working out of this sense that agency has to be kind of located in a point, an abstract, singular atomic point, into ways that where agency is understood in terms of relational fields. This is now my synopsis. And the importance of magical and mythological and mental, I would say, understanding the logic to, you know, how we understand how our role to play, how we can participate in an evolution, if that's what we're doing. I don't know. Can you guys help?
of the mob or of the archetypes speaking through groups. Now we're seeing the agency of groups. You've got the political parties and QAnon, and these are mental clubs, and they are cohesive, and they aren't really individual voices as much as they are collective voices, and they have agency.
And they're distributed, and yeah, they're networked.
Yeah.
And in a way, they also may be evoked. Like someone in the deep state, somebody, you know, may decide to do a psyops where they plant the seed of an idea. And, you know, having studied how these how language viruses spread, planted a language virus. And this becomes its own kind of entity in the space that affects how we live, affects things like elections.
Well, the language is poisoned now, isn't it, by associations? You know, conspiracy has become a word that is loaded with meaning. I mean, in the meltdown of our collective reality, knowing what to elevate as true or not is becoming increasingly difficult. And language doesn't seem to be up to the task of helping us find our way out of it, because the language itself is contaminated, even the words right and left.
Well, Ed is no longer with us in this call, but I think he's made the point a few times that he believes that it's not language that's the problem, but that we are, that, you know, we could relate to language differently or use it differently. And not fall into those same effects. I kind of tend to agree. And as a poet, that's kind of my job, like, is to find ways of using language that are not un, but maybe less contaminated by convention and by you know, more questionable motives. Like, not that my motives aren't questionable, but that is to say, to use language to evoke another kind of consciousness than what language is often used to do, which is to sell you things or control you or you know, what we are collectively trying to use language to do. Anyway, that's what do you think, John?
That's beautiful. Everyone has said some stuff that's really blowing my mind. So when I listen to this again, I'm sure I'll pick up on things that I missed this first time around. Thankfully, we have an archive, thanks to our blessed technology. So my feeling, though, is we tend to condemn viruses as, you know, they're vicious, they're terribly destructive, but viruses may have a virtuous side that we don't give attention to. And I'm open to that. Collectively, it would seem a few months before the virus, COVID took off and became global. Actually, Marco and I were in New York sitting in a cafe having a cup of coffee.
We went to the same museum.
We did. We went to the museum and we were having a conversation. We heard about this weird virus that broke out in China. What a shame. That's terrible, isn't it? I hope they cure it. Well, 2 months later, we're, we're in the same boat as the Chinese are, and the Italians and the Brazilians. So it's an amazing thing that I think there's a unification in a way that could be possible because of COVID and this global pandemic, which is really a first, I think, on this scale, certainly in with our technology that we have available. There may have been other pandemics, but I'm just wondering about that because we were moving very rapidly in this very it was all shaped by preemptively by all of these. Everything was routed in a certain direction, and it was unchangeable. We were told, and anyone who wanted to think post-capitalist was, you know, just branded as a loony, basically part of a fringe. But I think there's now. I think people are open to new kinds of narratives. And I think we're seeing this being played out on the political stages around the world, as you know, the threat of fascism is extremely real. You know, it's not business as usual, even though we may wish it were. And I'm here living in the middle of Manhattan. This is the biggest capitalist cathedral, if ever there was one. it's dying, my friends. It's dying very quickly. And I don't know what we're going to replace it with. I don't think we have a clue, but it's going to take a lot of imagination, collective imagination, I think, to make something sustainable and livable, and where we're focusing perhaps for the first time on human development rather than human exploitation. Wouldn't that be a lovely utopian idea? And I think our little our experiments here, this is what we're studying and are having these conversations, I think we could be creating the conditions for a future people who will have solved the problems that we find insurmountable now. So I don't think we've all lived in vain, that just because we showed up today shows that we're doing something useful for one another. So thanks again.
I heard Violet is described as a piece of genetic code. They're not a germ. They're a piece of genetic code. Zach Bush is a microbiologist who... And what I think is coming out of this is a new understanding of disease and a new understanding of actually how the body and viruses work, because we're full of viruses. The way they've defined this virus and the narrative that they've attached to what it is and how it works and what we have to do about it is, I think, highly contaminated with special interests. And I'm waiting for people to find their way out of this, because we are not having really sensible debate or discussion on COVID-19. We're not allowed to, actually.
Well, maybe we should schedule such a discussion.
I'd love to, if you guys are up for it, because I watch all of the material coming out and the sort of counter narratives, but there's no one from one side is talking to somebody from the other side in an exchange. We're in information silos where one side talks to each other and the other side talks to each other, but the two sides don't communicate. And it's making me crazy, because it isn't, there are all kinds of narratives about COVID and what it is, all kinds of narratives about how they're managing it, and all kinds of narratives relating to the human immune system and what's wrong with it that are related to how many people get sick. And there isn't any real forum where these ideas can be developed.
And of course, the virus is all about information, right? So because it is a information propagation thing.
Yeah.
And the immune system is interpretation of that.
Yeah.
The immune system is driven by endogenous imagery on a very deep level. Most of us are not aware of this, but I am. I spent 20 years in the AIDS epidemic, and I worked in a gay organization. I touched people who were suffering profoundly. A couple of hours a day, I was a Reiki teacher. And I used a lot of alternate ways of thinking about the immune system. And we used metaphor and story very intentionally to change the consensus reality. And I would hope, and we've done some research here together, and we've read some thinkers about the changes that need to happen. It'll be that kind of catastrophic collision, I think, to bring forward these new possibilities, because people will not change unless they have to. And I think, you know, and why should they? If things are going well enough, if it's not broken, don't fix it. You don't need visionaries if the system's working okay. But if the system is falling apart as it is now, we need visionary thinkers who have a sort of comfort with ambiguity and high levels of confusion.
I was going to say a session on rethinking the virus, and I was thinking, oh, well, we could inspire ourselves from Johnny and call it redreaming the virus.
I have to go. I have a
I do too.
A meeting coming up at the top of the hour. So thank you.
Thank you all. I have to go too. Blessings. Stay safe. Be resilient, everybody.
Bye-bye.